This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing clinical psychologist and accredited cognitive behavioural psychotherapist, Dr. Maria Lodes, who is a senior lecturer at the Department of Psychology at the University of Bath. Maria recently published a rapid systematic review exploring the impact of COVID-19 on social isolation and loneliness in children and young people. We'll focus on this in today's interview and also mood problems in adolescents. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review and do share with friends and colleagues. Maria, welcome. Thank you for joining me. Can you start by introducing yourself?
Yes. So as you said, Jo, I work as a senior lecturer in clinical psychology at the University of Bath, which means that what I do is help to train clinical psychologists of the future. Previously, I worked for many years in child and adolescent mental health services, and then came to the university. And what I'm really interested in is how we can best help young people who've got problems with their mood, and particularly those who've also got a chronic illness like cancer or HIV, to live the best lives that they can.
And as you've mentioned, you've worked in a variety of mental health settings, including various CAM services. And you were a CBT therapist on the Improving Mood with Psychoanalytic and Cognitive Therapy study, the Impact study. How did you come to be interested in this area?
Yeah, so when I was working in CAMS, I felt really frustrated by the lack of evidence base and attention for depression in teenagers compared to anxiety. We have pretty effective treatments, so CBT, for anxiety. And as a clinician, I could draw on that evidence of what tends to work to help the young people who came to see me in clinic, and generally they tended to get better. But the evidence is much more mixed and not nearly as well developed for those with mood problems. And what was so exciting about getting involved in the Impact study as a therapist was the Impact study was a massive step forward in helping us to understand more about what helps young people with mood problems.
And what did we learn then from the Impact study in terms of those sort of best approaches to take, specifically with young people with mood problems?
So I guess what I learned more than anything is that it's really hard to keep a young person with mood problems coming to therapy. So no matter which arm, there were three arms in the Impact study, three different psychological treatments that young people were randomized to, no matter which therapy a young person went into, it was really difficult to keep a young person engaged in coming to treatment. And in each of the arms, on average, young people only attended half of the sessions that they could have had. So I think that was the first really big learning point for me, was actually we've got to pay extra attention to how we can keep young people with mood problems coming back to therapy. And that's particularly important to attend to in the first meetings with them, to inspire them with hope and to instill in them the confidence that we know how to help, and that if they keep coming, we can enable things to get better. I think we also need to work harder with the systems around them so that the systems can help them to keep coming. And what I mean by that is people like parents, but also staff at school who might be coming into contact with those young people every day to keep encouraging them and supporting them to come to therapy. You know, I think sometimes it's practicalities that get in the way as much as the mood itself. So if it's difficult to do something and you're feeling low in mood, you're probably going to find it hard to problem solve. For instance, if you don't know how to get to your session, it might be hard to problem solve your way around that if you're struggling with your mood. So really enabling the system to help the young person to keep coming to therapy is important. Impact study was my first experience of working as a therapist on a randomized controlled trial. Normally, I would work in a routine clinic setting where young people and their families would be offered a range of treatment options and they would choose which one they felt was the best fit or which one they wanted. And in Impact, because treatment allocation was random, for the first time, I was working with young people and families who didn't necessarily feel that the treatment I was offering, the CBT, fitted with them and maybe they'd wanted something different. And really, I guess from that, it highlighted to me the importance of patient choice and of enabling patients to choose which treatment they feel best fits for them and that they're much greater in terms of buy-in if they've chosen which treatment they're going to have rather than a randomized control trial, which by necessity allocates them randomly, but means that people end up having something that doesn't necessarily fit very well with them.
Was it possible to be effective when you were working with people who had an intervention that was imposed that they didn't feel necessarily fitted?
I think to some extent it was. And the great thing about CBT specifically is that it's really collaborative and really engages the young person as an expert in their own difficulties and sets very specific goals that they are motivated in reaching. So by applying those basic principles of the CBT approach, often even if they weren't sold on the approach to begin with, it was possible to engage them in trying it out and experimenting with it. And they might then find out and discover that it was helpful and that helped their buy-in to it. There were a couple of instances where I think it was more difficult. And, you know, I don't know whether they would have been better placed in a different therapy or whether the same difficulties with engagement would have happened despite the therapy. But I guess that's always a question of if they could have chosen, maybe that would have empowered them. If they could have had a different approach, maybe that would have enabled them. Generally, I think using that collaboration and that let's experiment and try it out together approach, we had good success in overcoming that initial resistance or perhaps reticence to engage in CBT.
Maria, I want to move on to one of your current projects. I understand you've been involved in a Wellcome Trust funded project in South Africa around developing a school-based intervention for preventing anxiety and depression in young people. Can you tell us about this project?
I mean, the problem is this. In South Africa, rates of mental health problems are high. There are lots of factors that play a part in that, like poverty, violence, trauma, for instance, and also access to treatment, because actually there are very few mental health practitioners and a lack of freely accessible system for mental health care. So in that context, it's really important that we try to build resilience and promote well-being wherever possible to prevent mental health problems from emerging and to help these young people to weather the reality of their lives the best they can. We know that classroom-delivered approaches like the Friends program, for instance, which is CBT-based, have worked really well for promoting well-being and preventing anxiety and depression in high-income countries. But we know nearly so much about how that might translate to the South African context. What we've done is we did a systematic review to find out what approaches have been used in other low or middle income countries. And we found that there is some evidence that CBT-based approaches might be promising, but none have been trialed in South Africa before. And so we set out to develop a CBT-based approach to be delivered by counselors in classroom settings to young adolescents. So we know that the age of around 10 to 13 is when mental health problems really start to become quite likely to emerge. So we really want to target that age group at that vulnerable time. And what we did to develop our intervention was interview young people, parents, teachers, and counselors to find out their thoughts about this kind of program. And then use this information together with the knowledge about what programs have been used elsewhere in the world, like the Friends program, to create a bespoke program called the 4 Steps to My Future. And this program's got 4 parts to it aimed at enhancing self-esteem, developing emotion regulation skills, developing more helpful thinking strategies, and empowering goal-focused action. And we've now trained colleagues in South Africa to deliver this. And just as soon as schools allow for it post-lockdown, we'll be doing a study to look at the feasibility and acceptability of this program in practice in two schools in South Africa and getting feedback on it so that we can then look to do a larger trial in the future.
Okay, so it's not been delivered yet, but I'm just wondering how receptive were teachers, parents, and I don't know if the children would be aware of it yet, but how was it received?
They were incredibly receptive. We were really heartened by the response. There's a real desperation for this kind of input. And actually, parents wanted the same kind of help for themselves because they said they felt like they didn't have the skills themselves to necessarily deal with the realities of their lives in terms of mental health. So there was a real appetite for this kind of program. And even a year on from us having done these interviews, we've actually been getting back in touch with some of the young people we interviewed to find out how lockdown has been for them. And they remember us, they remember about our study, and they are still really enthusiastic and hopeful that this will be something that's implemented soon.
I do want to turn to your work on COVID-19 and its implications for young people's mental health. But before focusing on your own research, I was interested to learn there was a study from 2013 that focused on mental health outcomes for children in a pandemic context. And I just wondered what can be extrapolated from those older findings.
Yes, so that's actually a study we included in the rapid systematic review we did. So I do know quite a bit about it. It's a study from Sprang and colleagues who looked at trauma outcomes as reported by parents. So they had a sample of about 400 parents, about a quarter of whom reported on children who had been subject to social isolation or quarantine measures during H1N1, SARS, and the avian flu pandemics in America. What they found is that those who'd been subject to those disease containment measures were much more likely to require mental health service input and to have trauma symptoms as well as symptoms of acute stress and grief than those who hadn't been subject to disease containment measures. Now, there are problems with this study. So, for example, it relied on parent report and on retrospective recall, so it might be affected by memory biases over time. And there's also some detail lacking in the published paper, which makes it difficult to know quite how generalizable it is. So, for example, the paper is missing the data specifying the ages of the children being reported on. Also, what we need to bear in mind here is that COVID is so unprecedented as a pandemic because it's so universal. So in those pandemic contexts that Sprang had looked at, some children were exposed to disease containment measures, but most weren't. And of course, in the current situation, almost everyone across the globe is exposed to disease containment measures. So although the Sprang paper suggests that we might see an increase in mental health service need and in difficulties like trauma, we really don't know for sure. It might be that because everyone is experiencing this rather than just some people, that that's protective, or it might be completely the reverse. We just don't know. And it's really important that we see research coming out in this context that helps us to understand the emerging difficulties.
Okay, so let's turn to your recently published Rapid Systematic Review, which was published in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. So this explored the impact of the pandemic on social isolation and loneliness. What have you found?
We were interested in finding all the studies that have looked at the mental health impacts of social isolation and loneliness in children and young people. And we found that there was little evidence specific to the pandemic context. We only found that Sprang study that we've just talked about. But we did find much more evidence, though, that loneliness is associated with depression and anxiety, both when they're measured at the same time, but also over time. So loneliness is associated with later depression and anxiety in children and young people, up to as much as 9 years later. There's a wink that loneliness will increase as a result of the social distancing measures. And actually, that's exactly what we're seeing from the surveys that are being done and published in the COVID context. And it seems that young people are the group who are most affected by loneliness rather than older people. And actually, what our research is suggesting is that loneliness is one of the factors in the current context that could pose a future risk problem, a future risk factor, pardon me, for future mental health problems in children, young people.
So why is it higher in children and young people than, say, other groups?
Lockdown loneliness does seem to have been a particular problem for young people more than any other age group. And we think that that's most likely due to the developmental context. So it's important to remember that friendships are where we develop and refine our social skills. And friends and social life look different and have different functions at different stages of child development. So pre-primary, children mainly just play alongside each other. But at primary school age, friends start to become more important and play becomes a main way through which children connect with others. Although family relationships still remain the main influence on development for children at this age. Mm-hmm. Moving into the teens, though, friends become a very important source of identity and belongingness, much more so than the family. And it's really important for teens to have shared experiences with their peers. And the social group for a teenager is the way to experiment with doing new things, and especially things that are different from what their families do, and therefore to enable them to move towards independence. Mm. So because friendships have got such a developmental importance for children and young people, that's why we think that loneliness is much more of a problem for this group than any other group.
Is there likely to be a sort of missed window then of opportunity?
Two things. One is the kind of online interactions that they've been doing with friends and peers, and the interactions they've been having with siblings will at least to some extent make up for the gap that they've got currently in seeing people face to face. But also, I think generally young people are resilient and will bounce back. So once they have the opportunity to be back and seeing their friends in person, that's happening some now here in the UK. But as that increases, I think most young people will bounce back and will catch up quite okay. For some young people, I suspect they will get a little more stuck and they might need a little bit more help. And I think the people who might struggle most are the people who were lonely already before lockdown and for whom this has become even more isolating, that it'll then be really difficult to get back in to interacting socially once they get back out there again.
And that ties in with what you said earlier then, that the effect of loneliness can be lagged, a sort of time lag. So I'm wondering what that actually means in terms of understanding the long-term impact of COVID-19 on child and adolescent mental health.
Yeah, I mean, in short, it means that even several years down the line, we might still be seeing the mental health impacts of loneliness now. So I think loneliness has been an unintended consequence, but a consequence all the same of the disease containment measures. And actually, that could have a long-term effect.
As we speak, so schools and other services have started to open up post-lockdown. My understanding is that your findings suggest that children and adolescents are probably more likely to experience high rates of depression and probably anxiety. So not only during, but after enforced isolation ends. So what do you envisage the end of isolation will mean in terms of child and adolescent mental health?
Yeah, well, you know, we've talked already about the potential long-term mental health impacts of loneliness. But actually, I do think anxiety is going to be a particular issue as things open up. Anxiety around resuming life when there is still a level of threat in the world. COVID hasn't gone away, but also pressure, for example, academic pressure, pressure to catch up with the missed work, for instance. And, you know, I think that many children, young people are going to feel a bit wobbly to begin with. In fact, many of us of any age are feeling a bit wobbly going back out there into the world again when there is this threat still around and when there are things we're doing now that we haven't been doing for a long time. Mm, but absolutely. I do You know, I do think as we do things more, we'll get to feel more comfortable with doing them. But again, there might be some for whom the anxiety gets in the way of them getting back to doing the things they want to do, or their mood remains low. And those are the young people who are going to need that extra help from services. And I think we need to make sure that that help is on hand as much as possible, that they know that that help is accessible and that they can get it without having to wait for too long.
And of that help, what kinds of interventions and support systems are needed then to both help now and to prepare for this predicted future spike, let's say, in child and adolescent mental health problems?
So, well, you know, now more than ever, we want children and young people to be resilient, don't we? So we want them to be able to manage stress and cope with change and bounce back from difficult life experiences so that they can have positive outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so what we need to do to really build resilience and promote well-being is to build up protective factors and to decrease risk factors wherever we can. So our work has indicated that a key risk factor is loneliness. So we need to minimize the duration of loneliness wherever possible. And I guess for me, the key message is physical distancing doesn't have to mean social disconnection. And I think it's unfortunate that it's ended up being called social distancing, because actually I think that doesn't do a service to the fact that we can keep in social contact even when we're physically distancing. But as schools resume, I think we really need to prioritize a social and emotional catch-up as much as an academic catch-up. And reconnecting socially through play is really important. But also the academic expectations we set need to allow for this social and emotional catch-up. So we need to give messages to teachers and to young people and to parents that it's important to allow time for social and emotional catch-up on top of academic catch-up. On the other side, though, to build the protective factors, we need to promote well-being wherever we can. So I'm in favor of schools and communities, but also nationally sending out public health messages about activities that support well-being, like being physically active, socializing, doing enjoyable activities, having a daily structure and routine, for instance. And then for those young people who continue to struggle, I think we need to have that more targeted and individualized approach to help with mental health. So we need to make sure that children and families know who they can talk to if they're struggling, and that there are this range of supports in place. So at the lower ends of intensity, this might include kind of parent-led self-help approaches and computerized cognitive therapy-based programs, which generally have small but positive effects on mental health. But we know that those kind of programs tend to work best if there's some kind of therapist input. So we need to ensure that that's in place. And at higher levels of intensity, we need to ensure that actually more specialist mental health services are prepared to deal with that increase in demand, and that they can provide evidence-based treatments in a timely and accessible manner, including, of course, remotely while disease containment measures are still in place.
And is that happening? Is that input, that those types of support that you've mentioned, is that starting to happen?
I've heard of loads of great examples of schools putting in place ways to prioritise play and social connection and to promote well-being. But I'm concerned that these are case examples. And as far as I can see, there's nothing broader and it's not a consistent picture. We've heard from the Prime Minister about the academic catch-up, but I'm really keen to hear more about social and emotional catch-up for children and young people. And we know that emotional distress gets in the way of performing academically. So we really, really can't ignore this. If we want our young people to bounce back academically, we need to enable that social and emotional catch-up.
And your review team was involved in an open letter to Education Secretary Gavin Williamson emphasising that the ease of lockdown restrictions should be done in a way that provides children with the opportunity to play with peers in and outside of school. Now, I know from my own teenage children's experience that that isn't happening in all schools. So how might it be achievable given social distancing requirements?
Yeah, I mean, play is key to social development, as I've already talked about. But play also actually helps with regulating stress and with emotional processing. And those things are really important in this context. This has been very stressful for families, for children and young people. And there's also a massive amount of emotions that people need to process. So play helps with all of those things. And I do think there are great ways to be creative about how we can enable this even in the current context. So yes, the social distancing requirements are challenging, but parents, teachers, and young people working together can figure out the really most ingenious ways of overcoming these barriers. And I'd encourage them to do so in ways that are fit for their specific contexts.
And what else would you say to policymakers in light of the rapid review findings?
There's two clear things that I would like to see. One is clear public health messages about how to promote children's well-being, how to recognise mental health problems and where to seek help. And the second is to ensure that schools and specialist mental health services have funding in place that they can enable the right supports at the right time for young people who do struggle.
Are there any other key takeaways that you want to share from the rapid systematic review?
Yeah, I think what it highlighted to us more than anything is that although there is research out there, particularly around the pandemic context, actually we know very little. So it really does highlight that we need to ensure that we take the opportunity now to do as much high quality research as we can to understand for contexts like this going forward, if we might experience this again in the future, that we better know how best to help and that we have a better evidence base to draw forward.
And Maria, what else is in the pipeline for you that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, for me, an area I'm keen to work on is developing treatments for fatigue, whatever the reason for that fatigue. So we know that fatigue is a common symptom of depression in young people, and that it's also common in a number of chronic illnesses like cancer and HIV, for instance. And I'd really like to further the range of treatment options that are available for fatigue and develop the evidence for those further, including self-help options like apps, but also more therapist-led treatments like cognitive behavior therapy. We're looking at fatigue in adolescents with cancer and understanding their experience of that, and also starting to explore their thoughts about using apps as a way to help themselves to overcome fatigue. And we've also published some papers on fatigue in young people with HIV in Southern Africa.
And finally, Maria, what is your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation?
So what I would say is if your child or teen or children or teens that you're working with are presenting with symptoms that make you concerned about their mental health, don't hesitate to ask for help or encourage them to seek help, be that from the GP or school staff in the first instance who can signpost. For professionals, what I would say is do take the time to explore what lockdown has been like for children and families. The experience of lockdown has differed from person to person, and I think it's easy to assume that it's been the same for everyone, but we do hear stories of young people for whom it's actually been a blessed relief not to be at school and for whom they've done much better not being at school than they normally do whilst at school. So I think for professionals, taking that time to really understand what lockdown has been like for different individuals is really important.
Maria, thank you ever so much. For more details on Dr. Maria Lodes, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform, and let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.